In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. During the celebration of the Passover meal, the Jews praised God with the words of the great Hallel, consisting of Psalm 114 through 118. Jesus sang these psalms for the last time with his disciples before leaving the cenacle for Gethsemane. The words of the psalm gave expression to the feelings and the sentiments filling the heart of Jesus on the eve of his death. Lord, I am your servant, I am your servant, the son of your handmaid. You have loosed my bonds. My vow to the Lord I will pay in the presence of all his people, in the courts of the house of the Lord, in your midst, O Jerusalem. The cup of salvation I will take up. I will call upon the name of the Lord. I believed even when I said, I am greatly afflicted. I said in my alarm, no man is dependable. The cords of death encompass me. The snares of the netherworld seize upon me. I fell into distress and sorrow. I called upon the name of the Lord. O Lord, save my life. Return, O my soul, to your tranquility. For the Lord has been good to you. For he has freed my soul from death, my eyes from tears, my feet from stumbling. I shall walk before the Lord in the land of the living. The stone which the builder rejected has become the cornerstone. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his kindness endures forever. As Jesus left the cenacle, he took the same path traveled by David, who had to flee Jerusalem when his own kingship was threatened by his son Absalom. And Jesus and his disciples crossed the Kidron Valley to an olive grove called Gethsemane, meaning an oil press, on the west side slopes of the Mountain of Olives. It was indeed a path of sorrow for Jesus, as for David. As they left the cenacle, Jesus informed the disciples, "Your faith in me shall be shaken." For they were to see the good shepherd struck down to the earth, and his apparent weakness and powerlessness would scandalize them. They would temporarily lose faith and hope in Jesus. Both the good shepherd would rise again, but the good shepherd would rise again from the earth and go before them to Galilee. This time he would lead them as the risen Lord. When Jesus said, "For the scripture has it, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be dispersed," he sought to teach that what would occur, God had willed. Often during the Passion narrative, a reference is made to the scriptures. This indicates to the readers that what occurred is in keeping with the will of God. When we think of evil flowing from the will of God, we must understand that this evil flows from the permissive will of God. God cannot directly will moral evil. God can only directly will good, since his nature is love. The evil flows directly from the exercise of human free will. God directly wills human beings to be free. The freedom of humanity and angels flows directly from the love of God. Since God made people with a free will, God permits people to misuse his will or her will and to choose evil instead of good. When a person chooses to do evil, the evil flows from human being's refusal to love. Therefore, God is said to indirectly will evil. This is another way of saying that evil flows from the permissive will of God. God permits it. He is said to permit evil because the power of his love is greater than the power of evil. From the unlovingness of human beings, the love of God brings forth love. God will bring a greater good out of the evil. He will do this because he is God and God is love. The early members of the church were not theologians. They simply accepted all foretold in the scriptures to be the will of God. The only thing that made the sufferings and the death of Jesus tolerable and acceptable was that everything had been willed by God, as the scriptures indicate. When the gospel relates, the scripture says, it is but another way of saying, God wills it. These men would have made no distinction between the direct and the indirect or the permissive will of God. When Peter heard the prophecy of Jesus, he vehemently denied that it applied to him, perhaps to others, but certainly not to him. Even though all are shaken in faith, it will not be that way with me. Jesus particularly confirmed the truth of the prophecy in regards to Peter. I give you my assurance that this very night, before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times. But Peter still remained adamant. Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. With some people, you cannot tell them the truth about themselves. You have to let them learn the hard way. Peter's words but echo the feelings of the rest of the apostles. As we are told, they all said the same thing. This scene indicates a lack of humility in the disciples. Pride comes before the fall. Rather than accept Jesus' warning, flowing from his insightful knowledge of human weakness and his first-hand observations of his disciples' frailties, they prefer to rest complacently in the strong feelings of devotion and admiration they felt for Jesus. The scriptures warn that gold is tried in fire. Fire reveals the true nature of the metal. Often an object seemingly gold is revealed to have been only gold-plated. Apparently, at this stage, the apostles were only gold-plated disciples. We are encouraged to be humble and truthful about the future. We do not know what will happen within us when confronted by trials and sufferings now alien to our experience. The truth lies behind the saying, do not judge another Indian until you have walked a mile in his moccasins. The Holy Scripture warns, you who stand, take heed lest you fall. If we're overconfident and foolhardy, we may walk into dangers we are not sufficiently prepared to encounter. More often than not, we are overcome. If our enemy, as Paul writes, is not flesh and blood, but powers from on high, then flesh and blood will not overcome the enemy. Over and over, Jesus warned his disciples to pray that you be not led into temptation. Pray that you will be delivered from the evil one. Pray always that you may come through all that lies ahead of you. A wise and humble monk once cautioned a younger monk, pray that the urge to do wrong and the opportunity to do wrong do not come at the same time. Jesus knew the hour of terrible trial and test had come, not only for himself, but in a certain degree for all his disciples. He repeated warnings to them to be on their guard and pray. It went unheeded. His personal example to them was not followed. The disciples rested, self-complacent in their commitment to Jesus. They slept while he prayed, even though he had commanded them, stay awake, be on guard, and pray that you may not be put to the test. Jesus stressed the need to pray because the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Only in this text is the spirit contrasted with the flesh in the teachings of Jesus. The Greek words used are pneuma and sos. The pneuma and the sos, or the spirit and the flesh, denote the two extremes of human nature. The spirit of the pneuma describes the highest element in a human being. Some refer to it as the higher part of the soul. The mystics call it the divine spark in a human being. Here, spirit designates God and his world, his personal presence, and his grace. The Spirit of God is in a human being and is God's gift to that person. The flesh designates the entire person alienated from God and His grace. In other words, all that a human being has become through sin. The actions of the Spirit flow from the operations of God. It is the power of God in a human being. Spirit power is God power. It is God's will to continuously bestow this power on a human being, thereby give him or her victory over his or her weak flesh. Human nature fears sufferings, danger, and death. In the face of these things, fear subjects a person to temptation. If the disciple desires to stand fast in faith, if disciples do, they must open themselves in prayer to God's power to prepare them for what was to come, to strengthen them for the test. They did not pray, they slept. Like a black, ominous cloud, the trial came. They were confused and uncertain. Fear seized them, and they abandoned Jesus, leaving him alone with his enemies. We will see later that Peter sought to follow Jesus at a distance. This ended in denial of Jesus. Certainly, in this gospel narrative, the disciples' behavior, particularly Peter's, is contrasted with the behavior of Jesus. To appreciate the passion of Jesus, we must realize that through the incarnation, God's Son became a complete and total human being. He was humanity perfected and uncontaminated by sin. Jesus was so perfectly human that we can never appreciate the depth of sensitivity and emotional response that was his. Sin hardens man. It dehumanizes him. Sin never personally touched or contaminated his human nature and thereby his capacity to love and to be loved by God and mankind. It is of the essence of a human being's nature to love and to be loved. No human heart ever desired to love and be loved more than the heart of Jesus of Nazareth. Our sinful environment appears to precondition our hearts. We almost appear to be born with our guard up, with defensive patterns of human behavior that harden and make us callous to an unloving environment. People become cautious about loving others, a possible source of pain. Perhaps it is our survival kit for the hell we have made. And Jesus' whole being flows from the love of God, the gift of God's love to mankind, to every human being. Jesus had no defense nor caution when it came to love. When this is understood, we can know in some degree how the public life of Jesus was filled with deep spiritual sufferings. For during the days of that life, people refused his gift of love and refused him their love. If you have ever had the gift of your love rejected, you have a hint of the quality of sufferings endured by Jesus during his earthly life. Jesus saw no human being as his enemy. All people were children of God. They were his brothers and sisters and his potential friends. He never alienated himself from any human being. But people, bit by bit, alienated themselves from him. First, the scribes and the Pharisees, because of his loving interpretation of the law and appeal to sinners. Then his own kin and neighbors, because his loving deeds surpassed their concepts of love. Then the leaders of his people, because his love of God and truth threatened their selfish worlds. Then the authorities, who should have protected him because it was politically expedient to be a friend of Caesar rather than of God, then the crowd which had previously welcomed him because he failed to fulfill their unrealistic dreams of national glory. Lastly, his own disciples, because they became afraid of being his friends. In the Garden of Gethsemane, the psychological awareness of his complete and total aloneness and alienation reached its zenith. The disciples were physically present, but they were not truly with him. It was only a matter of time, a few more moments. Then they physically deserted him, leaving him to face his agony and death alone. Jesus was alone in the garden. This symbolizes man's total rejection of him and the withdrawal of human love from him. A heart that sought to love and be loved still loved humanity who offered him nothing but their hatred and indifference. Titanic waves of fear and distress engulfed his soul, and he confessed, "My heart is filled with sorrow to the point of death." These words express the thoughts of one who was dying of sorrow from a broken heart. Death was easier than life. He asked Peter, James, and John to watch with him, to companion him in this darkest moment. He truly needed them, but they slept while he suffered and prayed. Mark relates, he advanced a little and fell to the ground, praying that if it were possible, this hour might pass from him. He kept saying, "Abba, O Father, you have the power to do all things. Take this cup away from me, but let it be as you would have it, not as I." In this prayer, Jesus asked that God's kingdom might manifest itself to humanity in a way other than through the chalice that so overwhelmed his spirit. It was Jesus' wish in prayer to have the cup removed, but in prayer he realized it was the Father's will that the cup not pass, but that his Son drink it to the dregs. His prayer became a prayer of submission. Amidst his fears, he found victory over fear. His prayer of submission filled him. Calling God Abba reveals that despite all his pains and agony, he knew that God's love endures with a fatherly care and concern for him. As far as we know, no Jew before ever called upon God using this form of the name Father. Jesus knew he had a special relationship to his Father, which was different from that of all mankind. Only through Jesus did God become our Father. Jesus' prayer of submission gave him the power to willfully welcome and embrace all that lay ahead. His silence in his defense symbolized his total submission to the Father's will. The Father took away the fear from Jesus, but nothing but fear would alleviate the deadly pain, but nothing but death would alleviate the deadly pain in his heart. Jesus then announced to the apostles, "The hour is on us. You will see that the Son of Man is to be handed over to the clutches of evil men. Arouse yourself and come along. See, my betrayer is near." The word translated evil men means sinners. The word sinner was a synonym for Gentiles, the ungodly. It indicates that the hour of total rejection of Jesus by his people had arrived. It can truly be seen as a rejection of God by Israel, for handing God over to the ungodly. Mark writes, "Even while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, made his appearance accompanied by a crowd with swords and clubs. These people had been sent by the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders. The betrayer had arranged a signal for them, saying, 'The man I shall embrace is the one. Arrest him and lead him away,' taking every precaution. He then went directly over to him and said, 'Rabbi,' and embraced him. At this they laid hands on him and arrested him." When Jesus submitted to his arrest, fear seized the apostles, and Mark writes, "With that, all deserted him and fled." Mark adds an interesting note that has caused much speculation through the ages. There was a young man following him who was covered by nothing but a linen cloth. As they seized him, he left the cloth behind and ran off naked. Some hold it was a cameo appearance of Mark himself in his gospel. Mark indeed contrasts the behavior of Jesus in the garden with that of the three disciples as a lesson for the Christians at Rome. A Christian must not rely on the fact that his or her spirit is willing, but must be mindful also of the weakness of the flesh. It is essential that Christians watch and pray so that when the hour of trial comes, they may endure. It implied that the disciples might have stood firm instead of forsaking their Lord at the time of arrest. It may not have been just a coincidence that Peter denied Jesus three times and was found asleep on three occasions. From the wording of the Greek, Judas's greeting to Jesus indicated a profuse demonstration of friendship. At that moment, all the world could offer Jesus was a pretended friendship coming from one of the chosen 12 immeasurably increased the pain it inflicted upon Jesus. The mystery of Judas remains forever hidden in the secrets of his own heart. John declares he was a thief. Maybe he embodied the principle that no man can serve two masters. Man cannot serve God and money. He will love one and hate the other. No man knows the internal conscience of another. All we know is that Jesus chose Judas to be one of the 12. He was a most intimate companion of Jesus. Jesus evidently had a preferential love for Judas. Judas rejected Jesus. Maybe Judas embodied all those who expect a material and worldly return from discipleship. Maybe he followed Jesus for all the wrong reasons. No one really knows. We do know that the evilness of his deed came down upon him and he despaired, killing himself. The demons who encourage us to sin will always leave us alone with the discouragement sin brings. If Judas had only repented, what an example he would have been to sinners. What sinner would ever despair of reconciliation with God if he had had the example of Judas's being reconciled with Jesus? By his suicide, Judas stole from the Christian community even in his death. Mark wrote for Romans, and it appears he cautiously avoided anything suggesting that Jesus was a political messiah or that Christianity was a political religious movement. Mark omits any mention of an enthusiastic and disturbing entrance into Jerusalem of Jesus and his disciples on Palm Sunday. He does not directly mention any soldiers present at the arrest of Jesus. Mark relates that during the arrest of Jesus, a bystander caused a violent instance by cutting off the ear of one of the arresting men. The implication being that he was not an apostle, yet we know it was Peter. And Jesus' attitude at arrest did nothing to encourage resistance. He merely surrendered. Mark states that Jesus protested being arrested as a bandit or a revolutionary. You have come out to arrest me armed with swords and clubs as if against a brigand. I was within your daily reach teaching in the temple's precincts, yet you never arrested me. When Jesus appeared before Pilate, a reference to Jesus being the king of the Jews occurred five times. Pilate himself called Jesus the king of the Jews and offered to release him. Certainly no Roman magistrate would do such a thing if he believed that Jesus claimed to be a king. His claim to be a king was a threat or a rebellion against Rome and its authority. Jesus appeared so harmless in the eyes of the Romans that his claim to kingship was taken as a joke by the Roman soldiers. On the other hand, Mark seeks to emphasize that Jesus' arrest and subsequent death resulted solely from religious motivation, centering around Jesus' claim that he would build a new temple. He even states that Pilate knew Jesus had been delivered up to him out of envy. Mark's gospel presentation certainly helps us to form the classical Christian position concerning the arrest and execution of Jesus Christ. This position holds that Jewish authorities were the prime movers behind the whole plot because they did not believe the messianic claims of Jesus. They charged him with blaspheming, and they blackmailed Pilate into carrying out a sentence that legally, under Roman domination, they could not execute. Some scholars maintain that the Romans were the prime movers. They had feared Jesus as a possible troublemaker, and they had forced Jewish cooperation in his arrest. Today, many Christian scholars adopt a theory of moderation that although the Jewish authorities were deeply involved, all the main aspects of the arrest and trial were carried out by the Romans. One historical fact is clear. Jesus of Nazareth was sentenced by a Roman prefect to be crucified on a political charge that he claimed to be the King of the Jews. On this, Christians, Jewish, and Roman sources agree. The real problem concerns whether and to what degree the Sanhedrin or the Jewish authorities played a role in bringing about the crucifixion of Jesus. On the night Jesus was arrested, Mark mentions the presence of men with clubs and swords. Only Roman soldiers could carry swords. John actually mentions their presence at the arrest. With the presence of Roman soldiers as part of the arresting party, it is difficult not to see a strong hand of Rome behind the scene. Roman soldiers could not have been there without the consent of the Roman authority. It was obviously in the interest of the Christian community to avoid blaming the Romans for the death of Jesus, under whose tolerance and authority the community lived. The church especially did not want it said that there was any justification in the claim that the Lord was a political revolutionary against Rome. The process of exonerating Pilate and the Romans can be traced from the time of Mark's gospel. It is highly likely that it began before the written gospel era. As the gospels were produced by the Christian community, the position of the Romans seemed to improve. In the earliest gospel account, Mark writes that Pilate attempted to have Jesus released, but makes no great issue of his reluctance to sentence Jesus. In the Gospel of Matthew, Pilate's reluctance was much more noticeable. Not only did his wife tell him of her dream that Jesus was an innocent man, but Pilate publicly washed his hands of the business, proclaiming, "I am innocent of this man's blood." In Luke, Pilate solemnly states three times that he found Jesus not guilty. He sent Jesus to Herod in order to avoid passing judgment on Jesus, and even offered the Jewish leaders the compromise of having Jesus whipped rather than been put to death. In John, Pilate made a determined effort to pardon Jesus and actually did have Jesus scourged and presented to the people in an effort to win their sympathy. Pilate stood in awe of Jesus and seemed to fear that he was dealing with someone divine. This process of bettering Pilate's image continued beyond the New Testament. In the Syriac tradition, the passion narrative of Matthew was rewritten to make it appear that the Jews alone ill-treated and crucified Jesus. A later Christian legend tells of Pilate's conversion to Christianity. In the Coptic and Ethiopic churches, Pilate and his wife, Procol, have qualified as saints whose feast is celebrated on June the 25th. In the first years after Jesus' death, his disciples met opposition from Jerusalem leaders, even as Jesus had met opposition. It seemed to have abated for a while, but was rekindled after the fall of Jerusalem. By the time of the writing of the fourth gospel, the disciples of Jesus and the disciples of Moses were locked in bitter struggle. This opposition must have been more painful for the Jewish disciples of Jesus to bear as it came from their own people, for whom it was less excusable to have been blinded to the light of the world. In the eyes of these Christians, the Jews bore the greater guilt for his death. According to non-Christian tradition, both Jewish and Roman soldiers, neither Pilate nor the Jewish priest of the house of Annas, were admirable figures. Annas, according to Josephus, was appointed high priest by the Roman prefect Quirinius in 6 AD and deposed by Valerius Gratus in 15 AD. His five sons eventually became high priests. The house of Annas was noted for its greed as well as its wealth and power. The high priest Caiaphas was a son-in-law of Annas. That there was conclusion between Annas and Caiaphas and the Romans is suggested by the fact that he was able to hold office for 18 years. 10 of these years was under Pontius Pilate, so that the two men must have been able to work together when it served their purposes. It is noteworthy that as soon as Pilate was removed from office, Caiaphas was deposed as high priest. Jewish sources give us a rather full picture of the character of Pilate. He appears to have been an inflexible, merciless, obstinate man, continually given to corruption, violence, and cruelty of every kind. Even when allowance is made for possible exaggeration, his presentation in the scriptures hardly seems compatible with a man of such character. Pilate's term as prefect was marked by an outburst of Jewish nationalism, and he would have had every reason to be sensitive about someone who was hailed as King of Jews. According to Josephus, Judea was alive with guerrilla bandits. Jesus was a Galilean, and Pilate already had had trouble with Galileans. Among Jesus' 12 was Simon the Zealot, a revolutionary. As the Passover grew near, Jesus was a possible source of disturbance in the crowded city which had recently seen an insurrection. It was understandable why Pilate might have decided to take no chances and to put pressure upon the Jewish authorities to arrest Jesus before the feast. This need not mean that Pilate intended to crucify Jesus, but only that he wanted information and to remove Jesus during an explosive period. The Sanhedrin did fear Jesus' power over the crowd and the effect this could have on Rome. We read in John that they asked himself, "What are we going to do now that this man is performing many signs? If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away our holy place and our nation." It is likely these political fears played a role in causing the chief priests to work with the Romans in apprehending Jesus. Many of them may have used a political charge as a smokescreen for personal religious animosity to Jesus. If the priests wanted to get rid of Jesus because of their fear of Rome, this did not exclude a desire to get rid of him because he had attacked what was sacred in their eyes. There had been a similar reaction to Jeremiah. "This man deserves a sentence of death because he has prophesied against this city." A successful Messiah who was nationalistic would have meant political independence for the Sanhedrin and the glorification of Jerusalem and the temple. A Messiah who at the same time threatened to overthrow the temple could well have provoked religious opposition. Apparently, the arrest of Jesus was a joint cooperation between the Jewish leaders and Pilate. They had Jesus arrested in a solitary spot, lest he cause an uprising among the crowds present in Jerusalem for the feast. The arresting party was well armed and expecting trouble. Jesus was carried before the Sanhedrin for trial. They proceeded against him as a prosecuting body, seeking testimony by which they may put him to death, instead of sitting as judges on the question of guilt. They found, however, only false witnesses who testified that Jesus had threatened to destroy the temple built with hands and to build another in 3 days without hands. The question about Jesus' intention to destroy the temple could have certainly been interpreted as revolutionary. Apparently, Jesus did not make such a statement. John clarified that Jesus had spoken of his own body as a temple to be destroyed that would 3 days later rise from the dead as the new temple, not of this creation. This prophecy would be fulfilled by the death and resurrection of Jesus. The high priest then questioned Jesus in regards to this testimony, and Jesus implied by his silence that there was nothing to answer. Then the high priest asked him directly if he was the Messiah, which was the real question at issue. Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? Then in answer, the high priest received an answer. The time had come for Jesus to make his confession before the tribunal of the nation. To be silent then would have worn the look of abdicating his claim at a critical moment of his life. Then Jesus answered, I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven. Jesus cited here again the language of Daniel chapter 7 verse 13, applying it to himself. It is as if he had said, you will see fulfilled in me the fullness of the messianic prophecies. It denotes the place that Jesus was to occupy in heaven, and it pointed out that there would be earthly evidences of this power. They were to see with their own eyes the advancing kingdom of the Son of Man in the world. This denotes the intervention of Jesus as the messianic king in the affairs of the world. The whole statement means that they would see him exercising the messianic power. At that, the high priest tore his robes and said, what further do we need of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. What is your verdict? They all concurred in the verdict guilty with his sentence of death. Jesus was to die, for he was witness to the truth. One of the main themes of Mark's gospel is that Jesus only gradually unfolded to his disciples the secret of his own personality, and that the disciples were slow to comprehend his teachings. It was only at the very end of his life, when he was tried before the Sanhedrin, that Jesus revealed his true identity. After this testimony, Jesus made no secret of his claims. He admitted to Pilate that he was king. Mark stresses several times that it was the king of the Jews who was crucified. We are now told of the contempt the Sanhedrin had for Jesus. Some of them then began to spit on him. They blindfolded him and hit him, saying, play the prophet, while the officers manhandled him. Romana Gardini reflects, the Lord is in prison. Now baseness rears its head. From what evil depths must it spring, this hunger for revenge against holiness? It is in truth the hour and the power of darkness. The very moment Jesus made the good confession of faith before his enemies concerning the truth of his divine vocation, Peter denied the truth of his vocation. 3 times Jesus denied his association with Jesus. We are told he began to curse and to swear, I do not even know the man you are talking about. Peter lost his faith, and now he lost his courage and honesty. His courage was supported by his faith and fell with it. Why should he run any risks for a hope that had failed him? When Peter recalled the prophecy of Jesus concerning his denial, he wept over his weakness, but he did not take back his denial. Jesus was very much alone. The faithfulness of the Son of Man and the unfaithfulness of man stood now in sharp contrast. In John's Gospel, Jesus had affirmed, I am, signifying the fullness of life, a godliness, and Peter had equally affirmed, I am not. The denial had separated Peter from life itself. In the mind of John, if one was not a disciple of Jesus, he was not. It is the road of non-being. Mark, no doubt, places these examples before the Christian community in which profession of faith in Jesus could lead to death. He emphasized that any situation which calls for the confession of one's faith is appropriate for such a confession. When a disciple of Jesus is confronted by some person, even a servant girl, about his commitment to Christ, it must be acknowledged. When a disciple fails to testify, when questioned, to his or her Christian discipleship, the failure is sinful. The morning following Jesus' condemnation, the Sanhedrin met to form its plan. They bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. Pilate was no friend of the Jews. He despised them, but collaborated with them when convenient. Jesus must have been no more to Pilate than a helpless pawn in another political chess game. When Jesus appeared before Pilate, Pilate was already informed of the charges against him. He said to Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "You are the one who is saying it," Jesus replied. The answer appears uncertain to us. It may have been a qualified admission open for further clarification. Pilate was not anxious to pursue the subject. At this point, he introduced a character called Barabbas, a convicted murderer. He offered the Jews a choice between Barabbas and Jesus, the king of the Jews. The chief priests and the entire people rejected Jesus and called for his crucifixion. The entire Barabbas incident can be seen as a means by the Roman procurator to avoid having to pass a sentence of death on Jesus and to place the full blame for his death upon the Jews. With the chief priests and the people clamoring for the death of Jesus, Pilate could follow the standard practice and policy of Rome and hand Jesus over to them. There would be no reason against the crucifixion of Jesus from the Roman viewpoint now that the people had joined hands with the rulers against him. Underneath the scene, there may be more. The life, sinless one, Jesus, was murdered so that the sinner, the murderer might live. Mark likewise uses this incident to emphasize that as the Messiah, Jesus was crucified. For Mark, the title King of Jews was equivalent to Messiah. Jesus did not die for any evil deed, but precisely because he was the Jewish Messiah. Pilate now subjected Jesus to the cruel torture of scourging, an instrument of death in itself, and then handed Jesus over to the Roman soldiers for execution. Mark relates, "The soldiers now led Jesus away into a hall known as the Praetorium. At the same time, they assembled the whole cohort. They dressed him in royal purple, then wove a crown of thorns and put it on him, and began to salute him, 'All hail, King of the Jews,' continually striking Jesus on the head with a reed and spitting at him. They genuflected before him and pretended to pay him homage." This Roman circus, with Jesus as its clown, had all the appearances of a divine love being in the midst of hell itself. When they had finished mocking him, they stripped him of the purple, dressed him in his own clothes, and led him out to crucify him. Jesus went to his death totally rejected by this world, and literally excommunicated from his people, symbolizing in their minds that he was forever cut off from God. After a sentence of death by crucifixion had been passed, a tablet was prepared setting out the grounds of condemnation. This was hung on the person or carried in front of him on the way to execution, and when he was crucified, it was displayed on his cross. Such a notice would contain the name of the prisoner and the place of origin. In this instance, it read, "Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews." By this title, Pilate indicated that Jesus died condemned of no crime, but as the Messiah. By the gesture, Pilate no doubt intended to ridicule Jewish expectations. It appears to be no more sincere than the homage paid to Jesus by the soldiers. As Jesus had been exhausted by the scourging, they pressed into service one Simon, a Cyrenian, and made him carry the cross. Apparently, God does press people into his service, whether they like it or not, whether convenient or not. Jesus reached Calvary. They tried to give him a wine drug with myrrh, but he would not take it. The drug wine was given to criminals to dull their sensibilities and so moderate their sufferings. This was in keeping with the scriptures. Give strong drink to one who is perishing, and wine to the solely depressed, that their drink, when they drink, they will forget their misery and think no more of their burden. Jesus refused to drink, as he desired to be conscious during his sufferings. Mark's account of the passion is sober and concise. He did not seek to rouse sympathy or hatred. The passion was viewed primarily in the light of Psalm 22 and Psalm 69. These events had not been determined by an accident or human design. God's will had been the decisive factor. It had all been the inestimable price for the redemption of the human race. In Mark's mind, the physical anguish did not constitute the real sufferings of Jesus. He does not describe it. Rejection and hatred caused the real sufferings. Mark had traced it from chapter 3 in every conceivable variation and increasing measure, culminating on the cross with the two men condemned to die with Jesus. Mark writes, "The men who had been crucified with him likewise kept taunting him. They renounced their companionship with him as destiny had decreed, and in so doing made the loneliness of the passion complete. He did not even belong to those who suffered with him." As the end of his life approached, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" These are the opening words of Psalm 22. The prayer gives expression to the terrible and absolute loneliness suffered by Jesus. Not only has he been abandoned by people, but in this atmosphere of total hatred, there was no awareness, there was no experience of God who is love. There was a sense of having been abandoned by God. Yet the prayer expresses a faith in God's love that endures in every adverse experience, even when God is only experienced as the absent one. The cry expresses belief that God is real, even when experience and thought cannot lay hold of him, even when the believer feels forsaken, and when the resources of thinking and experience have been exhausted. Jesus' death is described with stark simplicity. There is no reference to any unshakable inner peace. One dying under such conditions could only die in agony. Mark alone groups together two events which happened at the death of Jesus: the rending of the temple curtain and the explanation of the centurion that Jesus was the Son of God. "And the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom." The centurion who was standing in front of him had seen how he had died, and he said, "In truth, this man was the Son of God." For Mark, the tearing of the temple curtain symbolized that from the moment of Jesus' death, the presence of God was no longer the privilege of the Jews alone. And the pagan centurion who confessed the divinity of Jesus was speaking on behalf of all Gentiles who were to later profess belief in his name. Here Mark presents his great miracle, the conversion of the centurion, that occurred not because of the words or deeds of Jesus, but through the saving power of Christ's death. The conversion of the centurion gave the reason for the death of Jesus and revealed the true nature of the person upon the cross. "A new temple is being created, and my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations." There are no friends nor disciples left to bury Jesus. According to Jewish law, a condemned criminal was to be buried in a common grave. We are told that Joseph from Arimathea, a distinguished member of the Sanhedrin, was bold enough to seek an audience with Pilate and urgently requested the body of Jesus. We read, Joseph took him down, wrapped him in linen, and laid him in a tomb which had been cut out of rock. Mark relates that at the crucifixion, some women were present at a distance. These women had followed Jesus when he was in Galilee and attended to his needs. Among these were Mary Magdalene and another Mary. Mark carefully notes that they had observed where Jesus had been buried. The Gospel of Mark ends with these words. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Salome, brought perfume oil with which they intended to go and anoint Jesus. Very early, just after sunrise on the first day of the week, they came to the tomb. They were saying to one another, "Who will roll back the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?" When they looked, they found that the stone had been rolled back. It was a huge one. On entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting at the right, dressed in a white robe. This frightened them thoroughly, but he reassured them, "You need not be amazed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, the one who was crucified. He has been raised up. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. Go now and tell his disciples and Peter. He is going ahead of you to Galilee, where you will see him just as he told you." They made their way out and fled from the tomb, bewildered and trembling. And because of their great fear, they said nothing to anyone. With this account, the Gospel of Mark ends. The remaining verses represent a compilation of the events narrated in other gospel accounts. They may well be a reflection of Mark's thoughts, for most scholars believe the original ending of the gospel was lost. It probably included the appearance of Jesus to the apostles and to Peter. It was considered highly improbable that Mark would close the gospel account with only the witness of the women to the empty tomb, for according to Jewish law, a woman's testimony was not legally acceptable. The gospel proclaims astounding news. Jesus had risen from the dead. If he had not risen from the dead, the world would never have heard of Jesus of Nazareth. For his disciples and friends, Jesus came to a tragic end, and to his enemies, a well-deserved one. It was only the subsequent experience of a risen Jesus that changed despondency to joy and fear into audacious courage. Those who had put their trust in him were rewarded beyond human expectation. It took a while, no doubt, to assimilate that Jesus risen from the dead, what Jesus risen from the dead truly implied. Once grasped, it enkindled a flame, inextinguishable, a destiny to set their hearts on fire and the world aflame. For Jesus was not a memory from the past, but a living presence encountering people through the ages. Time would not dim his memory. Time was forever his environment. His church, his body on earth, had work to accomplish to bring all people to a saving experience with their living Redeemer and Savior, who ransomed their lives by the shedding of his precious blood. He laid down his life for all people. And now all people might become friends of God. Mark's gospel account is ended, not finished. A Bible study ends without being completed. Mark left us before the empty tomb and in the shadow of the cross to forever contemplate the mystery of Jesus crucified and risen as the Lord of the kingdom to come. God bless you.